The public service invests a lot of time and money into developing its staff, but how effective is it? Hello, Richard Adie here with Best Practice. We'll get to that later in the show. Intelligence is a good indicator of how successful someone will be in their work, but it's not the only one. Personality can also be a powerful tool to predict performance. Ellie Gardner is a lecturer in the School of Applied Psychology at Griffith University. She's researching personality types, work, and an area called core self-evaluation, or CSE. Ellie, welcome to Best Practice. Core self-evaluation, what is it?
Core self-evaluation, so if you think about it as a scale for individuals who are high in CSE, so people who have this kind of positive view of themselves, view of the world, and then people at the other end as people who kind of view the world negatively, feel like they can't cope when they have challenges, don't feel like they have self-worth, it's unlikely that these individuals are actually going to be the ones who are going to be tackling very complex and challenging tasks. They're unlikely to be the individuals that are going to be satisfied in the type of work that they do or be pushed to kind of perform at high levels. So when we're talking about core self-evaluations, we're really thinking about what are the underlying traits that actually influence or drive someone to actually perform at a high level. And it's these things that are mixed up in CSE that actually, you know, push an individual to actually achieve those things.
So what we would, in as non-psychologists, think of as things like confidence and optimism.
Absolutely, yeah. So CSE consists of four main types of personality traits, I guess you could say. So it's actually a high order broad personality factor. And so what consists of CSE is actually self-esteem. So how you feel about yourself in terms of your worth, self-efficacy, which is about how well you think you can actually manage a challenge that you're faced with. So how capable you think you are of overcoming things. Low neuroticism, so being able to be emotionally stable and to kind of manage anxiety. And then the other one is called locus of control, which is about how much you think things are outside of your control. So some people feel like if something bad happens to them, there's no point, you know, worrying about doing anything about it because they have no control over their environment. And other people feel the opposite, so that they have a lot of control over what happens to them. And so that motivates them to actually engage in, you know, certain type of actions to change their situation. So all of these things together combine to create CSE. But what researchers, you know, prior to the stuff I've done found, and what I found also is that CSE is actually a better predictor overall than looking at these individual traits. There's something that happens when you look at these four things together that actually makes it a very powerful predictor of performance and satisfaction and other outcomes in the workplace.
So you get something emergent out of the four together.
That's right. Yeah. So it's kind of together is better than, you know, the sum of its parts. Yeah.
Now, is it a more powerful predictor than something like IQ, which is, you know, a very old measure, but one we're familiar with? We know if someone's clever.
Intelligence is a very good predictor of a number of work outcomes, for example, performance, that kind of thing. And when you're looking to recruit and select an individual, you might use something like intelligence or performance on cognitive type tasks as a predictor of that kind of thing. Having said that, personality adds an additional amount of variance in explaining how people can perform. So intelligence might be a better performer of performance than personality. Personality is still a very useful predictor, and it can tell you different things about different behaviours. So, for example, what types of work people enjoy doing, how they cope with challenging types of tasks and that kind of thing.
You've done some interesting research with a co-researcher, and what I found was that, in a way, the finding was unexpected. So you found, essentially, that low CSE is associated with low earnings. This is low core self-evaluation.
Yes.
But not high CSE so much with high performance and high earnings.
We were really surprised by that finding as well. So the study you're referring to, we used a national representative sample from the UK. So we had over 5,000 people take part in the survey, and it was a longitudinal design, so we could actually track people's progress. And we found that people who had low CSE, so had this kind of negative sense of, you know, self-worth and that kind of thing, actually had a 6% pay penalty. And what that equated to was about 2 to 3 years, you know, lost earnings over a 40-year career. So all the research prior to what we've done has shown that what we want is people who with high CSE, high achievers, people who want to tackle complex jobs, complex tasks, and that really the focus should be on high CSE. But we are the first to actually show that we should be paying attention to people who are low CSE, because they're, in our study anyway, we didn't actually find an advantage for people who were moderate to high, except for, it was just those people who are low CSE.
Mm. But the question that I then think of, and I'm sure this is something that you know the answer to, is how changeable are these types? If you're a low CSE person, can you become a high one?
Yes. Well, I think that's a really good question, because it comes back down to, I guess, the fundamentals of personality. So the literature is changing a little bit. We used to think that personality, whether it be CSE, you know, extroversion or whatever, is relatively stable and that it doesn't change over time. There is some emerging evidence, though, to suggest that personality does change a little bit over time. We found that over the 6-year period that we monitored it, there was a slight change, but there wasn't a lot of change. So people might oscillate from time to time to being slightly higher or slightly lower in CSE, but we didn't notice that there was kind of a significant shift.
So what are the implications for management or HR when it comes to staff development? Or is this all about doing the psychological testing before you appoint people and, I suppose, weeding out the low CSE? Because you can imagine some organisations would say, well, that's what I'm going to do.
Yes, and I don't necessarily think that's a bad approach. So, you know, my background is in organisational psychology, so selection is a really large part of the kind of work that I do. So I would always kind of say, well, look at your selection process, check how you're selecting. But an important part of that is actually looking at what job are you actually trying to hire for. So CSE is really going to be particularly important for jobs that you require someone to deal with very complex, non-routine type tasks. The research that we found with the British sample, the large cohort sample, we found that people who experienced a particular pay penalty were those who were in jobs where they had to be incentivized. So perhaps they were getting paid commission or bonuses and that kind of thing. And whilst, you know, there are lots of jobs that do have that as a component of their total pay, a lot of jobs don't involve that. So there might be some jobs where you do particularly want to try and recruit people who have high CSE as opposed to low, but there might be other jobs where it's actually not as important.
Mm.
I would also advocate, though, that selection is important, but also performance management and training is equally important. So although I don't think that you can actually, you know, enhance someone's CSE, because the research that we have and the theories that underlie CSE suggest that it is at least partially biologically based, there is some work that can be done around training people to kind of approach situations in a different way, to feel more comfortable in tackling challenging goals. And that, you know, can come along with things like, you know, building resilience, providing them training, giving them exposure to difficult tasks and giving them feedback. So taking more of that approach might actually assist some organisations. You know, I wouldn't say just find out who's low CSE and, you know, get them out of the organisation. I don't think that's going to be good for anyone.
No, indeed. But something you said just then made me think the future belongs to the high CSE. One of the things that we hear again and again on best practice is that the jobs increasingly that there is that we need people to fill are non-routine. They're about solving problems. So recruiters and companies are looking for people who can work in teams, good communication skills, good critical thinking skills. But high CSE would surely be a part of that palette as well.
Yes, I think for a majority of jobs, you would prefer someone who is moderate to high in CSE than someone who's low. But what I'm saying is that if you're someone who has low CSE or you have workers who are low CSE, it doesn't necessarily mean that they don't have anything to offer, because if we're wanting people to kind of solve these complex, you know, types of tasks or non-routine type tasks, then what we should be trying to do is make sure that there's an opportunity for people to exercise this in their role and that they have training and feedback along with that. So it's you know, if you think about the basic creativity research that's done by Amar Bhalle, it's not just about being a creative person. You could be the most creative person, have the most creative personality. You actually have to have creative components to your job, and you have to be supported by the environment of your organisation as well. So, you know, the individual can contribute so much, but the organisation also has a responsibility to provide the right environment and to make sure that the job allows for that as well.
Especially as we are seeing the decline of the traditional organisational career structures.
Absolutely. Yes, I think it's more and more important. But there's a lot of scope here for organisations to do really interesting and amazing things. And, you know, someone might be low in CSE, but that doesn't necessarily mean they don't have other things that they can offer the organisation.
Now, in some of your other research, Ellie, you looked at another personality in the workplace, the maverick, much beloved, of course, of fiction and films. What do they bring to organisations?
I argue that people who are mavericks or mavericks in the workplace are individuals who can actually offer a lot of energy, goal orientation, reward drive, and success in terms of actually, you know, these people really being motivated to achieve goals. The downside, though, is that we find that these individuals seem to want to achieve at perhaps any cost. So, you know, maybe disagreeing openly with people, putting them offside, maybe cutting corners, acting unethically. But the idea that I have anyway for driving this area of research that I'm interested in is that rather than having everyone in the organisation be selected on the same type of profile or having people who are in the team who are pretty much the same, sometimes we do need people who are a little bit different and who do have a different approach and who are willing to kind of stand up and say something different in order to make progress.
But you've got to, as you say, though, you've got to find a way of having them in a structure that doesn't tolerate them being a jerk all the same.
That's right. And I think the thing is that sometimes we do see that in the workplace where the people who are kind of the loudest, who kick up the biggest stink, you know, they actually end up getting their way. But we're finding that less and less. I think the thing to think about when we're talking about having mavericks in the workplace is really about how can we harness these functional aspects, so people who are goal-focused, really driven, really innovative, and how can we kind of manage more of these dysfunctional things like perhaps having difficulty working with team members, cutting corners.
So is that about processes or is it about culture or is it both?
I think it's about both. One is in terms of culture, making sure that people have, similar to what I was talking about before in terms of creativity, people have the freedom to express themselves and that is encouraged in the workplace. So if you do have a new idea, that there's some way that you can kind of put it out there and that be accepted as part of what people do in the culture of that workplace. In terms of processes, that there are clear processes that people need to follow in order to perhaps pursue these new ideas. And also, in the case of mavericks in particular, that there are processes that will be enacted if someone acts outside of these boundaries. So is there going to be some kind of disciplinary action? Is there a code of conduct for how you actually need to, you know, relate to people? But I think, you know, this is actually becoming more and more important to organisations because we're talking a lot about entrepreneurship within these larger organisations. So trying to think outside the box, have a lot of these maverick tendencies that entrepreneurs also have, but within these kind of established organisations. So there needs to be a lot of flexibility and a lot of space there for people to actually, you know, stretch and show what they can do. But organisations also have to be aware of, you know, some of the potential negatives of this as well.
Elle, it's been really interesting getting you on today. Thank you very much for joining me.
No, thank you so much.
Dr. Ellie Gardner is a lecturer in the School of Applied Psychology at Griffith University. This is Best Practice on RN, the ABC Radio app, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Addy. The public service makes a considerable investment in training and development. It spends more than the private sector, essentially growing its own talent. But given the time, effort and expense, is it having an impact? Well, to shed some light on this question, Associate Professor Vicky Browning from the School of Business at QUT has embarked on a 3-year study. Vicky, what do we know so far?
Well, it's interesting because in terms of course, we, you know, we operate, you know, while the university is a public service, we do operate outside. So we don't have absolute access to or understanding exactly how it's been done or any specific data. But we do know that there are programs out there that try and track whether the development they're doing with their leaders is actually having an impact. For example, in the Queensland government it has what they call an annual staff opinion survey, and through that they pick up whether in fact, you know, staff are seeing the leaders effectively acting or their leadership being effective within the Queensland government, and so they can act on that. But we don't have any specific data on that. However, we run quite a few programs in the public service, and we do quite a lot of evaluation of our particular programs that we run for them.
So you've got this 3-year study. How does that fit into all this?
Well, it's interesting because the 3-year study came about because they were asking that exact question. You know, if we're investing in public service managers and we're putting them on this graduate certificate, are we actually getting any value for time and the financial investment we put in? So that's how the study started. And I think it's a question that all senior managers, whether they're in private or public sector, are asking, because it is a considerable investment for them. And so that's what started or gave the impetus to this particular program. Or research study, yeah.
So you've got some key questions to kind of address, haven't you? So whether knowledge and skills have been retained and indeed sort of shared, that's an important one.
Yes. So one of the key things is most evaluation studies or evaluation to see whether a program's had impact tend to really not go that far. They tend to be very what we call snapshot research or even evaluation within organisations. And what they do is they tend to, when somebody attends a workshop or a program, they'll ask them, you know, did you enjoy being on the workshop, what we call happy sheets. Quite often, particularly if it's a university program, that obviously have assessment of learning. But that's often where it stops. And primarily it's because it actually requires much more sophisticated forms of measurement and also access, very deep access inside an organization to really understand what's happening. So what are the factors that are helping people share their learning and particularly their new learning, and how can organisations and individuals be empowered to do that? So that's what we are having a look at, and we have probably quite a unique situation in that most research that's been done in this area, they don't have in-depth access to organisations, and we do because we work in strong partnership with the Australian Public Service. You know, we present the Public Sector Management Program nationally, so it's a unique opportunity for both the Australian Public Service and for QET to actually do a really thorough study.
I'm intrigued. What are some of the factors that kind of affect how knowledge is passed through an organisation then?
Well, I mean, there are various factors. I mean, they tend to vary, but some of the key factors are, first of all, obviously the organisation itself. Does it have a culture that allows or facilitates or encourages people to share their learning? So often we think of about what we call a collaborative versus a competitive culture. So the collaborative cultures would obviously encourage people to be sharing. The other thing is, of course, supervisors themselves. So we are discovering in this study and other studies have discovered that, in fact, a supervisor is there to support a person who comes off a program, provides them with opportunities, coaches them. That is fundamental to them being able to use their learning. And of course, what is also key is the individual themselves. So what we're finding is that individuals, particularly in very complex organizations like the public service, if they take on the responsibility to navigate and to open up opportunities for themselves, that also plays a part in it as well.
One reference point is the Daffron and North work on how learning is transferred. Can you just explain that?
Well, some of the work that they've done, and in one particular study, is what they did is they had a look at, particularly in the legal practice. So their particular study was around judges, actually, but it's, you know, it was particularly around professional practice and how when professionals are trained or upskill, what helps them transfer that back into their workplace. And so some of the things that came out is not unusual in a lot of these studies. So one of them, for example, was that the more involved the learners are in actually co-designing the what they actually learn and how they learn, the more they are committed to their learning and the more relevant the content of the program is to them. And the other thing as well is how self-motivated they are. So I spoke about that earlier. So the more motivated they are to take their learning out, and that's linked to, and this is what we're measuring in our study, that's often linked to the sort of feeling of self-efficacy. You know, do I actually have the space or do I have a belief in myself to be able to do it? Their self-confidence. And what we find in a lot of the programs we run in the public sector management program is one, it just substantially builds people's self-confidence. And with that, they have the ability to actually use their learning. The other things they found is that if there's a variety of ways that the learning is delivered, so the way the program's designed is also fundamental to people's ability to be able to use their learning. So the closer it is to the type of situations they face at work, the easier it is for them to use their learning. So using case studies, using, like we use assessments where they actually have to apply what they're learning directly into the workplace. And also content that recognises the context that they're going back into. So, you know, if they come on a program and it's sort of very high level and it doesn't recognise the real challenges they have to deal with and gives them those real skills, then, of course, it's really not that relevant for them. So those are some of the things that came out of their study.
Do you have any early findings or indications at this stage?
Well, this is very early on in the study. I mean, we've done a a pre-measure. So in these type of studies, to avoid having a sort of a snapshot, just one collection of data, we are basically traveling or following the cohort over 3 years. So we're tracking their learning and some of the factors that are helping them and some of them are creating obstacles. So what we've done up to this stage, we've done what we call a pre-measure and we basically we surveyed them and they've indicated to us how capable they feel in some of the skills they're going to learn. We've also measured what we call psychological capital, which is looking at self-confidence, self-efficacy, you know, do they feel motivated enough? Do they feel that they're capable of actually learning on this program? And what we've also just started is a series of interviews. So the series of interviews really look at what are the factors that are helping them and the obstacles that are coming to play in terms of them applying learning. And what's sort of starting to come out of these interviews are a few things. One of them is that which I spoke about earlier, is that the individual, when individuals take responsibility for applying their learning and learning to navigate their way through the organisation, that's when they can start applying their learning. And when we talk about that, we talk about navigating through often a lot of organizational politics, power issues. And so there's another skill there, not just about applying their learning, but the ability to, you know, engage with the culture and engage with the organization and create opportunities for themselves. The other thing we're also finding is where there's a supervisor that is very supportive and to the extent where they coach, then the confidence of these particular people, because remember they're early on in the program, they've only done, these people we interviewed have done two modules or units, they feel a lot more optimistic that they will be able to apply their learning in the long run. So those are some of the things that are coming out in the early stages of the interviews. And I think they're just supporting a lot of what's out there. But I think it's also saying to us that it's not just about how you design the program, but it's also about the culture in which these individuals who've been on a program are in. Is it a positive, collaborative culture, or is it something that just shuts them down?
It's always about the culture. Yes. Vicky, maybe we'll come back to you in 3 years and get your results. Thank you very much for joining me today.
It's a pleasure.
Vicky Browning is an associate professor at the QUT Business School. And for more of her study into the effectiveness of management development programs in the public service, follow the link on our homepage, abc.net.au/rn. And that's the program. Best Practice is produced by Ian Coombe. Our sound engineer is Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. I'm Richard Adie.